Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Andor. That is a... It is a real pleasure for me to be here tonight on this occasion to speak on an episode of transforming importance in the history of my country. We are 80 years almost to the day from the start of the New Deal. We're also in the 50th year following the assassination of President Kennedy, and in the 10th year, almost to the day, from the start of the war in Iraq. So the arc of descent is quite long, and the sense of the task of recovering a sense of just possibilities is a daunting one. Now, I don't want to speak this evening from any undue sense of national pride, but to try to recover some of these now distant lessons of history. It is worth remembering, though, that the New Deal itself was inconceivable in 1930. And this was true even though, in parts of the country, the material conditions of depression were by then not at all new. They had been ongoing for 7 decades since the end of the Civil War. Northern U.S., European, and retrospective views tend to see the boom of the 1920s, the great crash of 1929, the Depression, and the New Deal as a single seamless national progression. In fact, the North American continent was deeply divided and had been for a long time. It was half boom and half broke, in Roosevelt's campaign phrase. And it was his genius to see and to say that a house so built could not endure. David Lilienthal, the creator of the Tennessee Valley Authority, expressed this aspect of the New Deal in a reflection on his first days in that job. He wrote, "The first steps seemed to me to revive Southern morale, almost shattered by generations of defeat and then self-pity, and to hammer home the basic primary need of increased income by demonstrations, as many demonstrations as possible, but always ones that the average man who had to carry the job ahead could see and understand. Electricity is something people understand and respond to. The fact that a fight is often involved doesn't hurt a damn bit either, for it dramatizes the point." In retrospect, we tend to link the New Deal to the name of John Maynard Keynes and to the implementation of monetary and fiscal policies, to the innovation of these instruments of economic control. But as Commissioner Andor has already said, when the New Deal got underway, the name of Keynes was barely known, and his influence in the United States was slight, even I might say negligible. The New Dealers saw themselves confronting not a simple failure of demand of spending power, but the collapse of a flawed structure of economic governance in the face of the rise of organized industrial capitalism, something which was by then not even a century old. Adolf Burley put it this way in an essay on the theory of the New Deal: "No longer can we rely on the economics of balance to take care of human needs. The effect of organization will distort and delay the forces leading to balance to a degree as yet unmeasured. The New Deal may be said to be merely a recognition of the fact that human beings cannot indefinitely be sacrificed by the millions to the operation of economic forces accentuated by this factor of organization. In other words, the New Deal expressed a willingness to declare, for the first time in the United States, that a government which until then had not existed must be created to deal with hitherto unmet problems, problems which were then substantially unfamiliar. Sweeping aside an ideology of complacency and indifference, yet preserving the core values, and here I quote Burley again, of great generosity and great recognition that individual life and individual homes are the precious possession. All else is merely machinery. In particular, as became very clear in the first days of the New Deal, the government understood that banks are merely machinery. They exist for under public charter and for public purpose. And if they do not perform that purpose, then the government has a responsibility to change the financial system wholesale. And Commissioner Andor has already summarized the sweeping and immediate approach of the New Deal to the financial sector. It is a commonplace nowadays to assert, and many progressives even do this, that the New Deal failed to end the Depression, that this only was the consequence of the Second World War. This is, frankly, a historical baloney, a shallow error. In fact, over the course of the 1930s, the New Deal built and rebuilt the entire country. 1 million kilometers of roads, 1,000 airfields, 1 billion trees were planted to deal with the Dust Bowl and the other environmental problems that had grown up with the mechanization of agriculture. The Lincoln Tunnel and the Triborough Bridge, if you're familiar with the geography of New York, the Chicago waterfront, every rural school and county courthouse, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Venable Power Authority, hundreds of hydroelectric dams, 2 aircraft carriers, which later proved quite useful, 3.5 million workers, including writers and artists, including Willem de Kooning and Jackson Pollock. And that is not to mention what came a little later, the Social Security, the minimum wage applied on a continental basis, recognition and enforcement of the right of labor to collective bargaining, and then as late as 1941, the 4 freedoms that Roosevelt articulated in his message to Congress of speech, of faith, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. My friend, the economist Marshall Auerbach, has established that unemployment correctly measured fell from around 25% in March of 1933 to less than 10% by 1936. It later went up again in the recession of 37. But by 1936, the climate was so changed in the country that President Roosevelt was reelected with the support of 46 out of 48 states, lacking only Maine and Vermont. So when did the Depression end? Contemporaries knew that it had ended by 1934. A sports writer wrote, "Wandering around the country with one or another of New York's baseball teams, I find that the national road to ruin is a thriving thoroughfare. It has been redecorated. People have come out of the shell holes into which they were blown by the explosions of finance and industry. They are working and playing, and seem perfectly content to let a busy tribe of professional worriers do their worrying for them. That was 1934. Now, the drawing of parallels is a dangerous business, but I will follow in the precedent set by Commissioner Andor and just draw a few for the European situation today. The first is that you have a problem of structure and governance, which is basically that the Confederate form of government is not adequate to the modern age. It is a formula for failure. And the accompanying ideology, which is that of an economics of natural balance, of adjustment by the forces of the market acting on people's incentives and on their material conditions, that is a formula which has been obsolete for more than a century. The remedy, second point, is to give these things up entirely and to attack the problems you actually have with a wide range of new measures, free of dogma, unconstrained by bankers and economists, undeterred by the optimistic but fallacious notion that things will start getting better on their own in 6 months' time, a notion which you have heard enough, and we have heard enough on our side of the Atlantic, to be thoroughly familiar with it, and using imagination and action with a primary goal, as was the case in the United States, of reviving morale across the demoralized European South. Third point, the precondition for doing this is recognition in the North that things cannot go on as they are. That the price of continuing down a path which is unworkable is ultimately the dissolution of society and the failure of the European project, just as in fact was the case facing Roosevelt in 1933. It was not an option for him to maintain the course that had been set by Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover. On the day 80 years ago that Roosevelt was inaugurated, there were machine gun nests set up on the rooftops of the federal buildings in Washington. It was a deeply dangerous and stressed time. The message had been delivered by 4 years of depression that things could not go on. That's why Roosevelt was elected in the first place. Possibly, the present downturn will deliver a similar message in Europe. Maybe things will have to get worse before it does. But voices in the North should take up the call now, aligning themselves with the defeated and the demoralized, with the Greeks and the Irish and the Portuguese and the Spanish and the Italians, with German and French labor, with Hungary and Romania, and with the immigrants from Africa and from Asia who are on the front lines of the distress in many parts of Europe. Ultimately, the future rests in their hands, not in yours and certainly not in mine. We have had the discussion of a social union. Finance Minister Mr. Moscovici this morning spoke of an union des sociétés as an essential measure of the project going forward. It seems to me, Commissioner Andor again gave expression to this in detail with respect to unemployment insurance, a minimum wage project. I would suggest that adding to this a common basis and foundation for pension systems are all ways in which one could, in a very short period of time, with a minimum of administrative overhead, begin to establish in people's minds the idea that the European Union can work in their interests and restore their confidence in its prospects. And finally, I would just say, be aware that if the right things are done, firmly and generously, the mood and the outcomes can change quite quickly. That's what happened in the United States 80 years ago. You don't have to wait for a complete breakdown of social institutions. You certainly don't have to await another big war. Thank you very much. That's my history lesson for this evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think it's more than a history